This interview is the last of a series with Father Malachi Martin on the situation in the church today. And this one is going to discuss the situation in Rome, where I believe you worked for several years, didn't you?
That's right, I did, Bernard. I did work there. And Rome leaves an indelible imprint on your soul. The Italians say, non si parte di Roma. You never leave Rome. And it's true. You never leave Rome in your spirit, even if you leave it in body. Because there's something about Rome that is both fascinating and holy, and something unholy. And perhaps it's the unholy element we want to talk about. It has always been an enigma for people outside, because all they see is a group of men running around in skirts with colored robes on them and taking part in ceremonies. And they wonder how the whole thing runs, what makes it go. And above all, in the present situation of the church, when we have shambles on every side and dissidents from papal authority throughout the church and in Rome, what's going on? What's happening? What's happening exactly? See, most Catholics don't realize the following fact, that it is our faith to believe. It is our faith to believe that the Pope will always be Bishop of Rome. That's our faith. Fide definita. The Bishop of Rome, the lawful Bishop of Rome, is the successor to St. Peter. Therefore, he is the personal representative of Jesus Christ on this earth, as long as he's alive. It's also our faith that, and this is called the factum Romanum, the Roman fact, that even if he ended up living in a forest glade in Tasmania, Rome would still be the center of the church, the see of Rome. That sticks in the gullet, to use an American phrase, of many modernists today who don't want a Rome-centered religion. But that is a fact, that the actual physical setting is part of our faith. Just as Calvary is the actual setting of Christ's crucifixion, and nobody can change that. So this location of the personal representative of Jesus on earth is a fact belonging to faith. It goes beyond history. And that's the complicating factor, because you have this man, he's a cardinal nowadays, usually has been for almost 1,000 years, over 1,000 years. He's elected by his peers. It's the only elective office in the official structure of the church. Everything else is appointive, in theory. Once elected, the cardinal electors who elect him don't give him papal power. They can't give him that. They haven't got it. What they do theologically is they say to the Holy Ghost, the Holy Spirit, that's the man we think should be Pope. And therefore, when he says, I accept it, the power descends on him. And from then on, he's totally separate from them. He is Pope. There's that one fact. And then around him is gathered a bureaucracy which is unequaled in its age, a chancery that existed back in the time of Charlemagne and before that, in the time of the Huns, the time of Gregory the Great, Leo the 13th, and still exists today and is the most skilled chancery that exists, and has suddenly come into its own in the, say, the Noriega incident, where everybody, including the President of the United States and the American Expeditionary Force and the Panamanians and all the American countries, found out that by far the best skill in diplomacy was used by the Vatican diplomats. They were utterly skillful in managing the entire difficult situation.
Do they have an intelligence network which is greater than any other in the world?
Sure, sure. That's why, finally, in spite of the Protestant opposition to it, the United States Senate voted to set up diplomatic relations with the Vatican, because the information pouring out of there, if you can get a hold of it, is accurate and total. It covers the whole world. And now, for instance, today, above all about Eastern Europe and Russia, Soviet Union and China, the Vatican is teeming with information on a 24-hour basis, coming from all over the world and about those areas, which is inaccessible, which is not accessible to other people. So it's a very valuable place. And there is this, not imperial, but certainly geopolitical attitude in Rome. They will look on a problem in Rwanda or Burundi, in the center of Black Africa, in light of all the problems connected with it, both in Africa and Europe and America, they have this total view of it all. They're geopoliticians, because they're in a geopolitical structure, which is very different from anything that the outside world has. The only other man who understands them perfectly is Mikhail Gorbachev, the present strongman in Russia, because he heads the only other geopolitical structure in the world, which is Leninism. That's why there's such a meeting of minds between him and Paul and John Paul too. They understand each other. They don't agree, but they understand each other.
Now let's bring it back from geopolitical terms back to local terms.
Yes.
You have many lay people are asking the question. We see everything going haywire in the church and all kinds of abuses going on. You see something is amiss. And why doesn't Rome do something to stop what seems to be almost the destruction of Catholicism?
I'll tell you, they are accurate in this sense. It is the destruction of the institutional organization, the visible structure. But it's a very insidious destruction, because the structure is left there, standing. There are cardinals and bishops and priests and dioceses and parishes and universities and schools and emissaries and meetings and conventions and congresses and synods. The whole thing seemingly, what are you talking about? The structure is still intact. But nobody except somebody very prejudiced would even think of saying that that structure is Catholic in the sense it was 30 years ago, 40 years ago. Pius XII couldn't stand a structure like that, nor Pius XI, nor any of the early popes, up to John 23rd. So the question is, what's happening? Why is that happening? Why isn't Rome doing something? Hasn't Rome got the power? The answer in shorthand, in simple, brief terms, is this. Rome itself has been corrupted. The bureaucracy has been corrupted. There is resident in the Vatican bureaucracy, small and limited as it is, but all-powerful, there is this anti-church partisanship which is out to change the face of Catholicism. And the church they envisage is something completely different. It's not a church centered in the Roman pontiff's rule. It's not a church which is centralized in Roman authority, jurisdiction. It's a Rome which heads a collection of autonomous communities bound together by ancient tradition and by sentiment, and of which the head, the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, is a very honored man because he's the 264th or 265th successor to St. Peter. But the Church of Peter, the Church of Pius XII, the Church of Pius V, the Church of Gregory XIV, they don't want that. They have another ecclesiology completely. And the theological underpinning, the theological belief at the back of it all is a different idea of salvation. You see, the Catholic Church is built on the principle that many are called, but few are chosen. The saved are few. Not perhaps the minority, but certainly not the totality. Whereas nowadays, the cry is that all men are saved. All faiths are equal. Just if you're a Catholic, be a good Catholic. If you're a good Presbyterian, be a good Presbyterian. If you're a Muslim, be a good Muslim, and you'll be saved.
So conversion is no longer the name of the game.
Oh, no. No. Catholic teaching is no Presbyterian is saved because he was a good Presbyterian. No Muslim is saved because he was a good Muslim. If I am a Hindu, and I'm a good Hindu, there's such a thing, I'm sure there is, but you've got to meet them to find out, and I'm saved not because I'm a good Hindu, but because the grace of the Catholic Church was communicated to me by some mercy of God. Similarly with a good Presbyterian, or a good Protestant, or a good Jew. If they're saved, not because they were good Protestants or good Jews, it's because somehow, in spite perhaps of my Judaism or my Presbyterianism, the grace of the Catholic Church was communicated to me, because outside the church there is no salvation. And they mean the visible church. Not the mystical body, they mean the visible church. But nowadays, as you know, the principle is that, well, we're all equal, let's be ecumenical. Remember, the word ecumenical originally meant Christians. Now, means anybody who gathers in who professes some religion, who's a Hindu or a North American Indian or an animist, he joins in the ecumenical gatherings. And they're all to be saved. They're all saved by being good North American Indians or good Buddhists, good Hindus, good Confucianists. That's the theological basis of it all. The old ecclesiology of the few and the many, the church of the elect and the others, is out the window for the modern theologian, and it has permeated Rome. And there is this, not imperial, but certainly geopolitical attitude in Rome. They will look on a problem in Rwanda or Burundi, in the center of Black Africa, in the light of all the problems connected with it, both in Africa and Europe and America. They have this total view of it all. They're geopoliticians, because they're in a geopolitical structure, which is very different from anything that the outside world has. The only other man who understands them perfectly is Mikhail Gorbachev, the present strongman in Russia, because he heads the only other geopolitical structure in the world, which is Leninism. That's why there's such a meeting of minds between him and Paul and John Paul II. They understand each other. They don't agree, but they understand each other.
Now let's bring it back from geopolitical terms back to local terms.
Yes.
You have many lay people are asking the question. We see everything going haywire in the church and all kinds of abuses going on. You see something is amiss. And why doesn't Rome do something to stop what seems to be almost the destruction of Catholicism?
I'll tell you, they are accurate in this sense. It is the destruction of the institutional organization, the visible structure. But it's a very insidious destruction, because the structure is left there, standing. There are cardinals and bishops and priests and dioceses and parishes and universities and schools and emissaries and meetings and conventions and congresses and synods. The whole thing seemingly, what are you talking about? The structure is still intact. But nobody except somebody very prejudiced would even think of saying that that structure is Catholic in the sense it was 30 years ago, 40 years ago. Pius XII couldn't stand a structure like that, nor Pius XI, nor any of the early popes, up to John 23rd. So the question is, what's happening? Why is that happening? Why isn't Rome doing something? Hasn't Rome got the power? The answer in shorthand, in simple, brief terms, is this. Rome itself has been corrupted. The bureaucracy has been corrupted. There is resident in the Vatican bureaucracy, small and limited as it is, but all-powerful, there is this anti-church partisanship which is out to change the face of Catholicism. And the church they envisage is something completely different. It's not a church centered in the Roman pontiff's rule. It's not a church which is centralized in Roman authority, jurisdiction. It's a Rome which heads a collection of autonomous communities bound together by ancient tradition and by sentiment, and of which the head, the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, is a very honored man because he's the 264th or 265th successor to St. Peter. But the Church of Peter, the Church of Pius XII, the Church of Pius V, the Church of Gregory XIV, they don't want that. They have another ecclesiology completely. And the theological underpinning, the theological belief at the back of it all, is a different idea of salvation. You see, the Catholic Church is built on the principle that many are called, but few are chosen. The saved are few. Not perhaps the minority, but certainly not the totality. Whereas nowadays, the cry is that all men are saved. All faiths are equal. Just if you're a Catholic, be a good Catholic. If you're a good Presbyterian, be a good Presbyterian. If you're a Muslim, be a good Muslim, and you'll be saved.
So conversion is no longer the name of the game.
Oh, no. No. Catholic teaching is no Presbyterian is saved because he was a good Presbyterian. No Muslim is saved because he was a good Muslim. if I am a Hindu, and I'm a good Hindu, there's such a thing, I'm sure there is, but if, you know, you've got to meet them to find out, and I'm saved not because I'm a good Hindu, but because the grace of the Catholic Church was communicated to me by some mercy of God. Similarly with a good Presbyterian, or a good Protestant, or a good Jew. If they're saved, not because they were good Protestants or good Jews, it's because somehow, in spite perhaps of my Judaism or my Presbyterianism, the grace of the Catholic Church was communicated to me, because outside the Church there is no salvation. And they mean the visible Church. Not the mystical body, they mean the visible Church. But nowadays, as you know, the principle is that, well, we're all equal, let's be ecumenical. Remember, the word ecumenical originally meant Christians. Now it means anybody who gathers in who professes some religion, who's a Hindu or a North American Indian or an animist, he joins in the ecumenical gatherings. And they're all to be saved. They're all saved by being good North American Indians or good Buddhists, good Hindus, good Confucianists. That's the theological basis of it all. The old ecclesiology of the few and the many, the Church of the Elect and the others, is out the window for the modern theologian, and it has permeated.
It seems that this super force is very powerful, because it seems to have the ability to frustrate work of men who, let's say, want to restore some semblance of tradition. For example, Cardinal Meyer has found himself frustrated in his work of working to restore the traditional Mass.
Yeah, he has found it impossible. He can't do it. After a certain point, he flings his arms in the air. He can't do anything about it, because the power of the Church is canonical. It depends on law, and who has the power to wield that law, the canon law. The wielding of that canon law is in the hands of people who are inimical to what Meyer stands for, to what the Pope stands for. And they can't do anything about it. You can't simply fire everybody all of a sudden. You have a completely decimated Church. It won't run. There'd be no control at all, no government. So the changeover of that means you weed them out slowly and replace them. But in order to replace somebody, say, in the congregation for the missions, the ministry for the missions, it's an elective thing. He's appointed or elected by the members of the congregation, but they themselves are affected. So you've got to fire them too if you want to clean it out. So how are you going to scour it all out? Find the proper men to replace them all? There are careers, people who went there at the age of 20 or 25 and are still there at the age of 60, and they have friendships and they have built-in positions of power. They can block motions. They can put things at the bottom of a pile of papers so it never comes up for discussion. The bureaucratic power is something out of this world. Diocletian, the emperor, decided that he would like to change the Roman bureaucracy of his time, and it was nothing like this. He took 17 years to even lop off the top of it, and then he didn't even succeed. And I think it would be impossible to clean up the bureaucracy itself. There is the Vandal solution, as you know, what Cordell Hull once said about the Secretary of State. The way you deal with the Secretary of State, he said, the Department of State, is you wipe it out and you put one solitary desk in the middle of a room and say, that's the Department of State from now on. You start at the bottom. Because the Vandals, as you know, came into a city, they wiped everything out. They left nothing. Just took the gold and the women, killed the children and the men, and went away. That's the Vandal solution, if you want to start anything. Wipe everything out and start all over again. Because you can't weed out the bureaucracy. It's the same thing now. The Poles have a difficulty in Poland, where they have a non-communist government, but there are tens of thousands of communists in every branch of government. How do you're blocked at every step. And the same thing in Czechoslovakia. Same thing in Bulgaria. Not so much in Romania, they were killing them and weeding them off. They have a quick solution for it all. Same thing with Gorbachev in Russia. He's up against this intense bureaucracy. The Vatican has the oldest bureaucracy in the world, and they're more salted away than anybody else. So the Pope is blocked in every way. And he himself is a traditional Catholic, a strong believer in everything that is traditional, and yet he has to sit on top of this pyramid and find that a decision of his to get people to stop using communion in the hand, which he forbade in the beginning, went nowhere. Because the principle was, let's violate his law, and in the end we'll have to declare it the local custom, which is exactly what happened. And that's why in a crucial thing, in a thing like communion in the hand, it's not so crucial, although it's a disobedience, but say women priests. We know that in the United States, that 32 women have undergone ordination privately.
Is that right?
Yeah. Now, we know they say Mass, as they say, they go through the motions regularly. Suppose they come out and say, we're priests, we're ordained by Bishop so-and-so, who is now dead, and they have a congregation. And suppose they keep on and on doing this. Eventually, their local people say, well, you know, Holy Father, they exist, and they're good priests.
It seems to me that sometimes to get things done, what the liberals do is they break the law, then it becomes a precedent.
That's right.
And then it becomes entrenched.
That's exactly what it is. I like confession for children before communion. The Pope has said again and again they must have confession before their first Holy Communion. Oh, no. And now it's become the common practice not to have confession before Holy Communion. Communion in the hand is the same thing. It's forbidden originally. Or communion distributed by lay people, originally only in case of necessities. In my parish church in Dublin, where I was reared from the age of 10 until 18, there are 5 priests, and they have 22 Eucharistic ministers. They don't need them at all. But now it's the habit. And originally it was forbidden, except in cases of necessity. General confession is another one. Case of necessity only can you have general confession. Now it's becoming a general habit. Because they're doing it anyway. They say, if we do it long enough, it's become a precedent and it's established practice. We can say to Rome, we've been doing this for years. How can you wipe it up? People are used to it. That's the principle. And Rome doesn't block it. If a law is violated in Ireland or in America, in Detroit or in Toronto or wherever it is, they should immediately, past the 12th, past the 11th, would have immediately expelled the people doing it. That'd be the end of it. Now that they don't do that, Rome is silent. Why? Because the people involved in Rome are in sympathy. Are in sympathy. Now, it is Rome. If you were to ask me about John Paul II, how many ministries would really stand up with him, behind him? I'd say 2, at the most. Really back him up? Only 2.
Which are those 2?
Probably the Congregation for the Defense of the Faith under Cardinal Ratzinger, and probably the marriage, the Rota, probably. But the others, no, they'd militate against him. They'd oppose his decisions, unless those decisions went their way. They wouldn't do it.
Let's take a look at Cardinal Ratzinger, because he is a subject of quite a bit of interest.
Yes, he is. He's a key man, too.
What are the strengths and weaknesses of his position?
His main weakness, is that he's isolated in the middle of a very modernist-minded clergy. And he has to deal with very modernist-minded bishops all over the world, including his native Germany and in America and Canada. Another weakness of his is that he is not aware of things. He's not aware of things. He comes to New York last year, gives a lecture here, and somebody asks him, what do you think of Father Raymond Brown, who's a scripture expert? And Ratzinger, without thinking, without knowing, says, I wish to God the church had about a half a dozen Father Raymond Brown. Now, Father Raymond Brown is, in my books, a heretic. He's written books about the New Testament that are totally unacceptable. Why did Ratzinger say that? Why did he say that? And in public? How could he wish that 6 of them, 10 Robert Raymond Browns on the church? God knows. But he did say that. So he's ignorant in that sense and unwary in that sense. And that's a pity, because he is supposed to be the head of the doctrine guarding the purity of the faith. Then he also, one of his weaknesses is that he's impotent. He cannot impose his views even when they are correct. For instance, how is it that Father Charles Curran still has faculties in the Diocese of Rochester? He can tell your confessions and preach. Ratzinger is the one who should send an order to the Bishop of Rochester, get rid of him, excommunicate him. He doesn't. He can't. Therefore, there's an innate weakness in his position from the very weakness of the structure itself. Similar with a Walter Casper, or a Bishop Layman, or hundreds of other bishops who are outside the church in their doctrine and teaching, and their behavior. The homosexual bishops we have in the United States who have known homosexual companions in their houses. Why can't he get rid of them? He can't. So he has that weakness in his position too. Then you see, there's something else about Ratzinger which is always causing people to think. It is that he doesn't seem to be aware of the suffering of people. He doesn't know what people suffer because they can't get Mass. He doesn't realize what poignant agonies they go through when they've got priests who are saying invalid masses or saying a form of the Novus Ordo which is obviously invalid. He doesn't realize it. He just doesn't realize they've been deprived of sanctifying grace through the mischief of modernist priests and bishops in the locality. He's closed away from the reality of pain that we're going through as a people. He's closed away from it. The same thing holds in Canada. He doesn't realize it. And in many dioceses in Canada, there are bishops who are simply acting in a way that's inimical to the cause of the church. When a priest wants to preach foundational Catholic theology, he's told to go. He should be able to write to Ratzinger, go to Ratzinger, and get installed and get the bishop flung out on his ear, because the bishop is a heretic. But Ratzinger doesn't do that. He's blocked in that way. Well, the Congregation of Bishops has its own point of view, and it's anti-John Paul II in ways. And John Paul II can't back him because he can't force the Congregation of Bishops.
Is this national conferences of bishops, in fact, a way of blocking Rome's authority?
Well, you see, the National Conference of Bishops, each National Conference of Bishops is now trying to develop into a community independent and autonomous, can make its own decisions about any subject, in doctrine, in faith, in practice, and Rome can't say boo to it. And that's the whole idea of the new idea of collegiality, is that. That the bishops of America can decide that it's good to have women priests. They can decide that it's good to have condoms. They can decide that in two cases, when the death of a mother is imperiled, or the life of a mother is imperiled, or the child is the result of rape, that there should be abortion. They can and will decide that. Or we must have deaconesses, they've decided that. They can decide that against the will of Rome and impose it. Similarly, the French Conference of Bishops and so on, the Spanish Conference of Bishops. Same thing, they want to be independent. It's a new form of an old heresy called Gallicanism, which was condemned as heretical, but now it's come out in this form. And Rome is incapable of doing anything about it at the moment, because the difficulty is this, that as long as John Paul II is Pope, it's fine. If tomorrow he died and they held a conclave, going down the roster of the papal electors, the cardinal electors, I am not sure we would not find ourselves presented with a modernist pope.
Is that part of the agenda of the modernists, is to get one of their own elected as pope?
Of course. That would be the end, then, of what they call the papal church, the patriarchal church, the ancient church, which is no longer suitable for the modern world. But you see, between now and then, there's a lot of water going to flow under the bridge. That's why John Paul II treads very warily. He wants no second assassination attempt. And he wants no real obstacles put in his way. He's engaged in something else completely. Some other mission, far removed from this problem. He tolerates this, tries to maintain a unity, a facade of unity anyway, and hopes that what he's hoping for will happen soon.
Is he aware that there's a problem out there? Does he have good information?
His eyes have been blinded with videos and his ears have been deafened with audio and his ears have been filled with accounts of it all. He knows it all and can do nothing about it. He knows he can't do anything about it. He can rant and rave, he can excommunicate and create a worse situation than ever. There's no way out. It wouldn't renew the faith. It wouldn't renew a seminary.
So we find a situation where the head of the church is hemmed in and is not really, in the true sense, the head of the church.
He is in the eyes of God. He is in the eyes of believers. But he's not. He's the head of the church without the power. He hasn't got the power. They are hoping that he will stop all practice, all attempt to practice, the Petrine office, so that it falls into obsolescence, into desuetude. And they can say, well, this has never been done for the last pontificate. The last pope never did this, so why should you do it? Speaking to another holy father.
It's to set a precedent.
That's right. And make it one of those relics stuck in a Vatican cellar that once was used and is no longer used. That's the idea of it. And they've come to that point to a large degree, that the pope's voice doesn't really hold in dioceses now. In the United States, but in Canada, it's not what the Pope wants, it's what the local bishop has decided.
The local bishop is really getting the best of both worlds, because he has, to a certain extent, still the authority from Rome.
Oh, yes.
He has
the
implicit approval of Rome.
That's right.
And yet he can still do everything he likes.
Oh, yes. There's no hold on that bishop, unless he really puts his foot in it. We have had a few, like Bishop Garrity out in New Jersey, who had to leave overnight, long before retiring age. But that's because he really made a mess of things. But others have got away with murder, and are still getting away with murder, and they can't be touched. Because Rome hasn't got the power to do it any longer. And the bishop seems to have the best of both worlds in that sense. I don't think he's going to have the best of the next world, but certainly of the two worlds, his own particular world and the Roman world, yes, he has the best of it for the moment. But what is he going to say to Christ when he's confronted at his particular judgment? And Christ said, "You dissipated the power of Peter who represents me. Why did you disobey him? Why did you listen to those Freemasons? Why had you got a homosexual lover? Why did you expel the homosexual priests? Why did you allow theologians teach heresy in my seminary? Why did you allow invalid masses? Do you realize the souls were lost by that? What is the poor man to answer? I was crazy, Lord. I didn't believe." Oh, boy.
Let's take a look at some of the key players now in the Vatican, perhaps some of the liberals who are part of this super force.
Mm.
And the first one that always comes to mind is Cardinal Casseroli.
Yes, well, Casseroli's role is not so much as a liberal, it is in his attitude to things. You see, nobody would think that Casseroli is... nobody would classify him as fervently Catholic and as pastoral in approach. Casseroli is a politician, cleric, who's been at this job for a long, long time and who would like to claim that it was his breakthrough when the Pope met Gorbachev. It wasn't, actually. It was John Paul II's achievement and his alone. To assess Cardinal Agostino Casseroli is very difficult for the normal man, because he moves in a world not inhabited by the normal man. Casseroli has been dreaming and planning of gaining access to Eastern Europe, to the Europe of the USSR, for so long, of reconciling East and West, and of a new era completely. He is not in any sense a supporter of capitalism, or the democratic egalitarianism, as we call it in the United States and in Canada. He is not of that ilk at all. He is much more inclined to think of another world order, a new world order, arranged along the lines of harmony and brotherly relationships and universal peace, none of which really are Catholic ideals, because the Catholic ideal is only realized in a soul that dies and goes to heaven, ultimately. That's the only one. His policy has been steadily pro-reconciliation, pro-cultivation of the Marxist world, and it hasn't cohered very well with John Paul's geopolitics and his concept of what the church should be. Any discussion of details of Archbishop Cardinal Casseroli's life and administration enters too much into the security of the Vatican and enters too much into the security surrounding John Paul II, and is best left unsaid. But the judgment on him, in my judgment on him, is rather negative, because there is no doubt about it that he has maneuvered the church in a way, both behind the scenes before he became Secretary of State and since he was Secretary of State, in a way that is not inspired by the idea that Christ must be the king of the whole world, or is the king of the whole world, and his kingship must be vindicated. That's the main grumble and grouse that I would have about Archbishop Casseroli as such.
Are there any other key players in Rome that we should discuss?
Well, there's none that have effective power. There was a man who has become a cardinal ever since, Cardinal Silvestrini now, who was another grey eminence working in the Secretariat of State, who I think at one time wished to, and perhaps he does still wish, to succeed Casseroli, because Casseroli is coming to the end of his term. He is 75. He should be offering his resignation. He may be allowed to stay on. That is, it may be impossible for John Paul II to shift him. But Silvestrini was another grey eminence who, again, directed the church in its foreign policy along paths that don't cohere with the pastoral and the supernatural mission of the church. You see, all these men are priests. All these men are clerics. All these men are supposedly devoted to the kingdom of Jesus. All these men are supposed to spend their waking hours and some of their sleeping hours working at that. But an examination of the administrative decisions they make and have made, and the men they appoint, of the policies they implement, of the strategies they adopt, don't point to men who are laboring for the kingdom of God. They point to politicians who are looking for the aggrandizement of some worldly power, one way or the other. Have some of them been bought? Yes. We think some of them have been bought. Have some of them merely been corrupted by power? Yes. We think some of them have been corrupted by power. Have some of them sold out to the enemy? Doubtless. There are people who have sold out to the enemy. Because that's the only way you can explain certain things. Minor details, for instance, as the conclave that elected John Paul II met on Saturday, October 14, 1978. He was elected on October 16. There was no agreement on that Sunday between the two main factions in the conclave. But listen to this as a point of what we know can happen in the Vatican. So they went to bed that night with no pope and no prospect of a pope. And then the next morning, suddenly throughout the whole conclave, Cardinal Karol Wojtyla's name from Krakow, Poland, started rising to everybody's lips. And he obviously was going to be elected pope. They had to arrange things and talk over it, but that was it. The first people to know that was the Polish Communist Politburo in Warsaw. Now, wait a moment. The conclave is locked up. There's electronic surveillance. Nobody can communicate with anybody. How did the Polish Politburo know that Karol Wojtyla was going to be pope? Would be announced the next day. They did. So there are people who are bought, people high up, and it is inevitable. It was always the way. But in this world of ours, where the combat is very close and where the enemies are very, very intense, this is a very, very serious thing. And especially when you have a man like John Paul II walking on the edge of a cliff all his life as pope, this is very, very serious. So he's not, in other words, at home in his own house. And even though he has brought Poles in, his entourage, a lot of Poles in, and a lot of friends in, he still is face to face with the general bureaucracy and the habits already formed and the friendships already formed, and he can do nothing about them.
Is there much corruption in Rome?
Yes, there is. Not an enormous amount. Not an enormous amount. Any egregious sexual corruption is immediately killed off when people are ejected. That's not tolerated for very long at all. You'd never have what we have in the United States, bishops with a homosexual priest companion perpetually with them. That would be impossible. The occasional priest or monsignore or parish priest with a mistress in the country, yes, it does exist. We know it exists. Priests who go to brothels, I'm sure they do. I don't know any instance, but I'd be very surprised if they didn't. Money corruption? Yes, a lot of money corruption. Because there's a lot of money floating around. And there's the Vatican Bank, which is a great source of revenue for a lot of people. And yes, there's a lot of that corruption. But the real corruption is the corruption of power, the cruelty of power, the wielding of bureaucratic power to pave your own way, climb over dead bodies, bite the hand that fed you, and in general succeed the man who helped you stand up in the first place. Yes, there's a lot of that.
What is sad, it seems, is that a lot of this raw use of power doesn't really take into account the feelings of the lay people out there who are trying to practice their faith under very difficult circumstances.
No, it doesn't take that into account at all. There's no feeling in Rome for that at all. In the higher echelons, they're cut off from it. They're not ordinary people. They have no problem.
So they're living in a world of their own.
That's right. That's right. They are just as the people in Washington live in our bureaucracy, live in a world of their own too. They don't know what happens in Peoria, Illinois, even though they go there, so to speak. But they don't even go there. They can't go to the Universal Church in Rome. They live apart from it. Now, balance it all by saying there are hundreds of holy men and women in Rome, priests and religious and nuns. Hundreds of them. None of them occupy high posts. Holiness is not compatible with that sort of bureaucratic life. It's simply not compatible. You can't stand it. You can't take the lies. You can't take the deceptions. you can't suffer the ambitions, which has nothing to do with the salvation of men. It's purely and simply human ambition and vanity and pride and factionalism and divisiveness and gain and advantage and the pride of life and good eating and good living and traveling at the Holy See's expense. So it has nothing to do with salvation.
Let's take it back to the laity, though, who are trying to work out their salvation.
Yes.
Many of them see these abuses in the parishes and in the diocese. Mm. And so they sit down and write to a cardinal, quite often Cardinal Ratzinger.
Yeah.
And they'll send all kinds of documentation about these abuses.
Yes.
And then they don't hear back. Nothing gets done.
That's right. And Rome loves it. Rome loves it. Because as long as it has the papers, that's all that matters. Now, any deviation from rule, any revolt, is what they can't stand. But they don't mind all the letters and the paperasserie, as the French call it. Rome is full of paper. And there's no difficulty there. But the idea of taking up what the little widow in North Carolina has written about what the parish priest doesn't or does do, oh no, that's like me climbing beneath the closet to kill a fly. You know, it's not their concern. They're not concerned about that. And de facto, the little widow in North Carolina who does write that letter, what she has to do is to pray and put up with it all, because that's the way the church structure has been built. And until God changes it, we've got to put up with it. That's our cross. And we've got to pray for it. There's no change. There's no change in the offing even in that. That's not going to change. And I know organizations of men and women in this country, they've gone to Rome, a whole group of them, financed themselves, and they've written out their objections, complaints, and difficulties, and they've gold embossed the book, and they wait for the cardinal, they put it into his hand, and they receive his blessing, and they get a letter about a week later saying that His Eminence has read it, and he feels that the church is blessed by having such fervent Christians. Period. Full stop. That's it. And Rome is delighted. These people are faithful. Faithful to them, they come to them with their complaints. Nothing is going to be done about it. Rome is never afraid of paper. Paper is not what frightens it.
Mm-hmm.
Rome is only frightened by a man like Archbishop Lefebvre, who says, I'm going to consecrate four bishops.
Let's take a look at the Lefebvre issue and others as well. It seems almost as if Rome is, on the one hand, protecting some of the bad people out in the field. You have all kinds of heretical theologians, and nothing is done about them. And yet you have, let's say, people, traditionalists like Archbishop Lefebvre or Father Nicholas Gruner, and every attempt is made to suppress them.
Well, take Archbishop Lefebvre and compare him, say, with probably the outstanding heretic today, Hans Kuhn. Since Hans Kuhn has been declared a non-Catholic theologian, let's take Charlie Curran or Walter Kasper. They don't consider Walter Kasper a danger or Charles Curran a danger for one reason only. He didn't challenge their power. He's just talking theology, and who cares about that? Archbishop Lefebvre said, I'm going to validly consecrate four bishops with jurisdiction. That's challenging power. He's challenged canonical power. Now, their answer was to take out the howitzer and blow him out of the water. That's why they put forward this excommunication of Lefebvre. He challenged their authority. Whereas they're not going to challenge Walter Kasper or Charlie Curran for the simple reason that there's no threat there.
So Rome does not feel threatened by heresy anymore. It doesn't see things as much in theological or ideological terms in the new church.
No, it only sees it in terms of power. Partly because a lot of people in Rome share the heretical views, they're no longer Catholic. And partly because those who are Catholic would like to do something about it, haven't got the power to do anything about it. They can't muster the signatures to get a Charles Curran condemned or a Walter Kasper removed from his bishop's chair. So the only thing left that they do value is their power, their jurisdiction. And that resides in the bishop who can consecrate priests. And therefore that's why they ultimately turned on Archbishop Lefebvre and sent out this bill of excommunication against him.
And that's why they don't, let's say, send out a bill of excommunication against Charles Curran.
That's right. That's right. He does not bother them. He bothers the local people. He bothers me. He bugs anybody who's listened to him talking or read his books or studied his life. But that doesn't bother Rome an awful lot. It bothers, but they regard it as something which is passing. It doesn't challenge their position, whereas their jurisdiction and their power, that's their soul. That's their soul.
Now, we've discussed the infighting going on in Rome. Is this infighting mainly based on power, or is it two ideological camps?
Based on power, based on two camps of power, or two camps fighting for power, both camps differing in their beliefs. One is Catholic in the traditional sense. The other is neo-Catholic and is not Catholic any longer in the traditional sense. It's neo-Catholic. It wants that loose aggregation of communities all over the world that profess to be Catholic and honor the Pope as the honorable chairman with a casting vote amongst peers, amongst equals. But the centralized church of Petrine authority is no longer their ideal. In fact, it is ancient and outmoded as a way of looking at the church's government. That is a pity. It means that the infallibility of the Pope, the primacy of the Pope, is challenged. They're both dogmas of faith. These people say, well, it must be reinterpreted. Of course he's infallible under certain circumstances. Of course he has primacy under certain circumstances. But we must redefine that in the face of new realities, which means that he's not infallible and he has got no primacy.
But they phrase it in such a way that they can get out of what they're trying to say.
They're always trying to get a new understanding of something. It's not quite what you fellows say, they will say. It's something else. Of course he's infallible, certain infallibility, and he has a certain primacy. But it's not what you call it. It's not what you say it is.
But they're very clever.
Oh, they're extremely clever. They hold on, and spread it throughout the church. I think if you were to ask, go around, say, the parishes of these United States, and there are about 400 or 500 parishes in the whole country. No, they're more than that, but whatever number there are, I think you'd find that rarely does anybody preach about the infallibility of the Pope or the primacy of the Pope, and most people don't believe it any longer, just as they don't believe in the real presence of Christ in the Blessed Eucharist any longer. It's symbolical. You can't exaggerate too much. It's not cannibalism. We're not eating Christ. It must be much more human and modern and scientific and reasonable for modern people. How can you say you eat Christ in the Blessed Eucharist? How can you say the Pope can command people in Texas to do what he says? It's the world is too large. He can't decide for every nation and every ethnic group and every race and every culture. So they finesse everything to the point that the ancient dogmas fly out the window or are torn to tatters.
And of course, one of these is the Petrine authority. Let's take a look, perhaps a bit closer at this present Pope, and what his strengths and what his weaknesses are.
Yeah, his strengths are manifest and his weaknesses are manifest. John Paul II's strength is that he has not yet once violated one rule of faith. He has not yet once said or taught anything which is against faith. And that's an awful lot to say for a clergyman today. He has proven, therefore, to be totally Catholic. Where his weaknesses lie is in his effort to compromise as much as possible so as to divert any trouble from his head, because he has enough trouble already. And there he has, I think, made prudential mistakes. When he found out they had arranged, for instance, the day of Assisi, if you remember, in 1986.
Yes.
He should have said, I'm not going. He didn't. He went along. He didn't arrange it. They arranged it. He should have refused to go along with it. When he found out that they were out to kill off Archbishop Lefebvre, he said, no, I'm going to atone myself, he should have said, and done, and gone. He should have reconciled with Lefebvre. It was very easy. Or put off the evil day. He didn't. Trouble. He couldn't deal with it. Too much trouble. And you could go down to a long list of things of that nature where he has failed to settle questions. For instance, the whole question of religious liberty. He should have decided that. It's a burning question in the church, and various people are giving their opinions about it. The general idea nowadays amongst the neo-Catholics is that you're free to do what you like. You're free to practice error. That's your human right. But you must be sincere in it. The church has always denied that. No man is free to choose error. No man is free to choose error. And you can't say that people are free to be what they like. They're not. They have to come to Christ through the Catholic Church. That is Catholic doctrine, because outside the church, there is no salvation. He hasn't clarified that issue.
He hasn't taken the burning issues, therefore, of Vatican II and cleared up the ambivalence. Ambivalence about collegiality, ambivalence about religious liberty, ambivalence about the Mass. What finally is a valid Mass? What finally is a valid Mass in the name of God? He hasn't cleared it. Though on those three points, there is weaknesses. He has not cleared them up. Obviously, he has decided that he'd better not touch them. It's the hornet's nest. It's too much trouble. It's danger. It's peril for him. Nor has he cleaned up the point about Petrine authority. Is he really finally primate of the church? Has he really got the primacy? Because he doesn't exercise it. What does Vatican II say about it? It's ambivalent. It can be interpreted. And they have interpreted it in the anti-Petrine way. He hasn't cleared that up. That's bad. Then there's the big, big difficulty, which, you know, can be poignant. I'm sure he wakes up at 2 o'clock in the morning sweating over this one. It's the following. If I'm head of this house, and there's a large group of you living in the house, and I know there are 3 men there who go out at night and they mug and kill people. I know that. I don't do anything about it. I am guilty. I'm guilty of what they do, because I know it. I have the authority to stop them, and I don't. John Paul II knows that there are blasphemies committed in parishes. He knows that certain bishops are homosexuals and living openly as such. He knows that certain ordinations are invalid, and if he doesn't, he should, but he does. He does nothing about it. Hey, in normal terms, he'd be guilty of the same sins by indirection. He doesn't know anything about it. Because he has judged that that would bring a storm on his head and wipe him out.
So for the time being, he's trying to paper over these divisions in order to keep peace.
Yeah. Is that the wisest course? Is that really Christian? Is that really Christ-like? I don't know. I wouldn't like to have to make that decision. Because when the Jesuits tolerated Father Drynan in the Congress of the United States, who pushed abortion funding, for 10 years they did nothing about him. And therefore, the Jesuit general and the local superiors here and the superior of this house were all guilty of the same sins. Finally, John Paul II said, get out of politics. He did. Not because he was pushing abortion funding. He didn't mention that. He said because priests shouldn't be in politics. He attained the same result, but with a different mode. But in the meantime, Jesuit superiors were guilty of it. The Jesuit superiors who tolerated Marxist Jesuits in Nicaragua were guilty of the sins of those priests. That's common morality and common law, by the way. So John Paul runs the risk of being guilty of sins committed by his permissiveness. And that is grave. That's very grave, because Christ is going to say to him, you knew these things were happening. Why didn't you do your damnedest? If they killed you, so what? They killed me. What's killing got to do with it? That's the difficulty. Now, John Paul's judgment is he's got to wait, hold on, because the alternative is worse. He thinks. He's got to hold on until Our Lady comes. But that brings us to the whole outlook, vision, and policy of what he's about. In the beginning, when he started his papal trips, people said, well, why doesn't he just stay at home and administer the church? Clean up the mess, go out the Augean stables, wash away these things, attend to details. Master the congregations, enter into the politics of the Vatican, cut off heads, you know, reform, renewal. He didn't. He insists on going abroad. He's going to Mexico this year, amongst other things, and he's going to the Soviet Union, and he's been on 44 trips, I don't know how many countries, speaking so many languages, and he's going to go on traveling and tripping around as Pope in that white Alitalia DC-10. Why? Well, he has said so on several occasions. Why? He has said that Our Lady wishes him to act in such a way that the maximum number of human beings will have seen him in the flesh or in TV image and heard his voice with their ears or on audio before she comes. He has a reason for it. Secondly, there is the fact that from all that can be made out, from all that can be discerned, it will be during one of those trips that Our Lady comes. He won't be in Rome when it takes place. And thirdly, his attitude is this. The world is rushing into a new world order. They're going to have a world structure. I want to be the most prominent man alive. And he is. Do you realize that in the whole 6,000 years of known history, we have never known one man who was seen by 3.5 billion people and heard by about 4 billion people? Only John Paul II is the only man alive we know about whom that can be said. So he's achieved an international profile of high density. He's the one man that can be identified by anybody, black, white, or sky blue, pink, east, west, north, south, Chinese, or Western, or Russian. Everybody knows John Paul II, the first pope in history, the first man in history, totally identifiable by pygmies in the forest, by businessmen in Wall Street, by junk traders in Hong Kong, by anybody. They know this man. He set out to achieve that. And he said that he did that because at the moment that they approach the superstructure, he will have a say as the vicar of Christ.
So he's anticipating the new world order then.
Yeah.
Let's take a look a bit at his Marian devotion or his Marian theology. It seems to play a large role in what he's doing.
Yeah, his motto, as you know, is totus tuus, which means you're a complete slave. And he's talking about Our Lady. He's convinced about Fatima, that the Fatima promise is going to take place during his lifetime as Pope. He's convinced, in other words, that the curse of Fatima, as it's called jocularly, that is, as you know, the third secret Our Lady predicted there would be calamities. Whole sections of the continents would be washed away forever. Whole nations would perish. There would be natural catastrophes that would level humanity. She has promised that. She says that's going to happen. You can't mitigate it, the Pope says. It's going to happen anyway. And that whole nations would lose their faith. Now, he believes that firmly, that it's going to take place like that. And hence one reason for him to be a sign of salvation on that day. If people remember his face, remember his voice, that God will give them the grace on that day to lift their eyes to heaven and say, have mercy on us, and be converted. That's his outlook on it all. And there's a lot to support him in that. And this is the chariot, the motor that drives him in his work and in his perseverance, because any other man would have been broken by what he's been through. I mean, if you have been shot at like he has and felt hot lead in your body, been laid low by people you know, I think after that you'd retire and lead a very quiet life and administer your parish wherever you are and stay quiet. John Paul hasn't stopped. He hasn't stopped in Poland, he hasn't stopped in Russia, he hasn't stopped in Europe, he hasn't stopped in the Americas, he hasn't stopped in Asia. He's still going strong, stronger and stronger every day, and has more influence every day of the week. He increases his influence, and he's accepted amongst the secular leaders of our world as somebody so agile in diplomacy, so expert, so knowledgeable, they can't do without him. There are 116 nations now have embassies at his holy see in Rome, and they insist on having it for information, for influence, for his counsel, for his general power. And this man has got an army. So it has paid off in that sense. But his idea is that he is an instrument of Our Lady and of Our Lady of Fatima. In other words, he's going to assist at the conversion of Russia. He doesn't call the present movement in Russia a conversion at all. It's a Leninist plot. Gorbachev being a hardcore Leninist thinker. That's his attitude to Our Lady. He is tenderly devoted to Our Lady. He has a great devotion to her, had always, is consecrated to her, has consecrated Poland with Cardinal Wyszyński in his day, back in the 1960s, and has consecrated the world to Our Lady, and is waiting for the time that he will be allowed to consecrate Russia to her Immaculate Heart. He says he's not allowed at the present moment. So he's totally devoted to Our Lady. In that, he's made many enemies. When he wrote, for instance, a letter in February 1982 telling the bishops that he wanted to consecrate Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, some of them never answered him. Some, like Cardinal Hume, answered and said that they couldn't propose that to the people. They would be scandalized by it. Can you imagine the bishop writing that to the Pope? They did, though. And they regard him as a Polish bishop who's gone astray and ended up as Pope of the Church when he should be in a diocese in Krakow in Poland, hidden away. Kind of meddling with affairs that he shouldn't meddle with, and imposing his conservative views on a church which is trying desperately to advance and join humanity. and be part of the human race. So he has enemies, dire enemies, who would like to see him dead and out of office. And failing his death by human hand, or failing getting him out of office, they want him to retire. After all, he's 70. 5 more years. He, by the way, according to canon law, can retire, resign, and nobody need ask him a reason, and he'd give a reason to nobody. It's in canon law. And they would like him to declare of 75, but he's retiring because of old age, because of ill health, and because he has outlived his usefulness and he can help the church in other ways, and then put in their own man. But they forget one factor. He is the personal representative of Jesus. And believe me, Bernard, there's nobody more vengeful than Jesus when it comes to what belongs to him. And there's nothing he prizes more than his church. And nothing the church prizes more than Peter, on whom he built the church. And those who are now tampering with the papacy and tampering with the Petrine office and planning to get rid of the last man who stands as a guard over it, they are facing a Christ who is full of wrath and anger, not forgiveness, not compassion. You have touched the very reason he came on earth. And that promises for them a terrible punishment, also for us, because we happen to belong in the same caravan in history. But the caravan which is winding its way towards a crossroads where I think the times of Satan are finished, and we're going to see a time of surcease and peace for the church for a while, until the last big struggle comes. And that's Antichrist. And that's the end for him.
Thank you, Father, for participating in these interviews, and I hope they have been helpful to our listeners.
Thank you very much, Bernard. It's been a pleasure. It really has.